A caravan against the blockade of Cuba arrived in the nation's capital this weekend after a 1,300-mile march from Miami.
The blockade is the main obstacle. Why is it implemented? We will never stop to deny this genocide policy because it's the main cause of our problems.
And a solidarity movement to send much-needed syringes to Cuba for its massive COVID vaccination program is underway.
There is no family that can escape from the effects of the blockade at any given time.
Will the voices of 184 countries calling on the Biden administration to put an end to the U.S. embargo against Cuba be heard? From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and radio affiliates. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. This month, Cuba is in the spotlight of the powerful U.S. corporate mass media and its allies in the so-called international community. The intensity of the message resembles the pre-Yugoslavia, pre-Libya humanitarian interventions a la Democratic Party. On July 11th, groups of protesters, like the 2014 Venezuelan Guarimbas, or the paid mobs hired by Western intelligence in Iran in 1953, made their grand entrance on the world stage, demanding freedom and calling for the end of tyranny in Cuba. Had a strong backing by social media outlets from the United States mainland. The news agency AFP reported that between July 5th and July 8th, there were 5,000 tweets of the hashtag SOS Cuba used to mobilize people. It then exploded to 100,000 on July 9th, 500,000 on the 10th, and 2 million on the 12th. The explosion of tweets was triggered by multiple foreign accounts, but Cubans on the island were led to believe that it was coming from inside their country, an action designed to motivate more people to join the party. Cuba hadn't received this much media attention from the U.S. media and friends since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. While protesters claimed they were fighting against blackouts and for more anti-COVID vaccines, videos show them walking out of the vandalized stores with household items and electronics. The massive media coverage by the U.S. and its allies around the world suggested a psychological operation. Why now? Has this ever happened before? Yes, according to John Stockwell, former CIA chief of station and author of In Search of Enemies, a CIA Story.
At that point, the journalists, Reuters and AFP, the management was not witting of it. Now, our contact man in Europe was, and we pumped just dozens of stories about Cuban atrocities, Cuban rapists. In one case, we had the Cuban rapists caught and tried by the Ovimbundu maidens who had been their victims, and then we ran photographs that made almost every newspaper in the country of the Cubans being executed by the Ovimbundu women who supposedly had been their victims.
But these were fake photos?
Oh, absolutely. We didn't know of one single atrocity committed by the Cubans. It was pure, raw, false propaganda to create an illusion of communists, you know, eating babies for breakfast and that sort of totally false propaganda.
Just days after the U.S. was humiliated at the United Nations General Assembly, where the final vote count read 184 for the Cuban side, 2 for the USA. The debate was centered on the U.S. embargo against Cuba. Preceding the loud media outburst was also the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse of Haiti by U.S. and Colombian mercenaries, some of them trained by the United States as part of the so-called war on drugs. Was this a distraction? The move also coincides with U.S. and NATO forces conducting military maneuvers at the Russian border while China finances the construction of a transoceanic canal in Nicaragua. Upon completion of the canal, Chinese investments are expected to rise and the U.S. to continue losing its grips on the world economy. Since 1959, the Cuban Revolution has crossed some very powerful corporations and organized crime figures who lost a juicy cash cow in Havana, where the mafia had its Caribbean headquarters. The industrial, mining, and agricultural operations worth over $1 billion back then, plus the lucrative tourism industry with its hotels, bordellos, drug runners, and consumers, no doubt were a tremendous loss. By the late 1950s, U.S. financial interests included 90% of the Cuban mines, 80% of its public utilities, 50% of its railways, 40% of its sugar production, and 25% of its bank deposits. The Declaration of Independence by Cuba was met with waves of punitive actions. Planes flying over spraying toxic fumes and disease in the countryside, sabotage to agriculture machinery, terrorist attacks to hotels and other tourist sites, and an international blockade that now threatens the survival of the entire population. Cuban ambassador to the UN, Pedro Luis Pedrosa Cuesta, spoke to Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York City, about the effects of the embargo on Cuba.
I think what has been happening in Cuba, or what happened in Cuba last week on Sunday, we have to refer back to what was written in 1960, as early 1960, by the then Assistant Secretary of State Lester Mallory to the president. If we want to overthrow the Cuban Revolution, we have to create discontent in the population. We have to create the condition for the population feels unsatisfaction. So what we're seeing in Cuba is very much the concretization, the materialization of that, is creating everything possible, particularly through the embargo, to create maximum hardship to the country and to the people of Cuba. So the disturbances that we saw last week and Sunday in some localities in Cuba are really the result of a well-designed plan by the government of the United States of America to exert maximum pressure on the government of Cuba and on the Cuban population at a time when we're facing a really complex situation derived from 16 months of coping with the pandemic and its current resurgence in the country. In addition to the very severe tightening that everybody knows of the blockade, particularly the brutal restrictions imposed on the Cuban people during the times of pandemic, there has been over 50 new measures, economic measures in times of the pandemic that have made extremely difficult more importantly for the people to cope with the limitations that the blockade has imposed all over the Cuban economy, because the consequences of the blockade are multidimensional. I felt in every and single area of the Cuban economy, and there is no a family that can escape from the effects of the blockade at any given time. So this has seriously affected the normal functioning of the Cuban economy by critically reducing income from exports and goods and services, access to fuel, medicines, and medical supplies in general, putting a lot of pressure on the population and on the capacity also of the government to confront the situation of the pandemic. All the effort has been directed to confront with the pandemic. Of course, that has had consequences in other areas that are there, but because the scarcity of resources, we have not been able to address them. But the point is that this situation has been very opportunistically used to create this environment of discomfort in the population. And we also would have to talk at some point about these disturbances produced last week in Cuba has been financed to a great extent from abroad, from official sources, but also from covert sources.
That was Pedro Luis Pedrosa Cuesta, Cuba's ambassador to the United Nations, speaking to Pacifica Radio WBAI in New York City. Outrage of the colonial power merely repeats what London, Washington, and Paris did to Haiti in the 19th century for daring to be free. After all, Haitian African enslaved people generated the most important source of revenue for France. Cuba's revolutionary example was not to be forgiven either. Here's journalist Max Blumenthal speaking on The Jimmy Dore Show about the many acts of terrorism and violence perpetuated against the island nation and its people by the CIA and other representatives of the U.S. empire.
The history of terror in Cuba, CIA terror in Cuba, is disgusting. I mean, and it continues today. With Operation Northwoods, it was signed off on by the U.S. government, by the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the Pentagon. JFK, he had to call it off at the last second. This would have been an attack on U.S. citizens. Then you have 1976, the bombing of Cubana Flight 455 by Luis Posada Carriles, a CIA agent, killing scores of Cubans, civilians. They killed the whole North Korean Olympic fencing team went down in the flight. Posada Carriles bragged, "We put the bombs." Him and his accomplice, Orlando Bosch, were ultimately brought to Miami, and Miami inaugurated Orlando Bosch Day when Jeb Bush was the governor of Florida. I mean, honoring terrorists. Then you have biowarfare by the CIA against Cuba. In 1971, Newsweek revealed that that a virus from a U.S. military base had been sent by fishing boats into Cuba. The next year, swine fever was introduced by CIA agents, the African swine fever, to Cuba, killing 500,000 pigs, forcing Cuba to basically wipe out its entire pig population, which led to hunger and massive food rationing. I mean, this is well-documented stuff. A biological warfare against Cuban poultry production was introduced years later by the CIA. The CIA has introduced hemorrhagic conjunctivitis and dengue fever into Cuba, killing possibly hundreds of people, diseases to kill Cuba's sugar crop. A leader of a Cuban terrorist group in 1984 called Omega 7 admitted in a U.S. court that he participated in U.S. biowarfare against Cuba. And, you know, it continues today. In softer form, the United States Agency for International Development, which coordinates closely with the CIA, is now run by Samantha Power, who presided over the destruction of the state of Libya and was a huge advocate of the death squad operations in Syria while pretending to be a human rights advocate. The USAID has a program to undermine Cuba's program of sending doctors to neglected areas across the global south, particularly in Latin America. And as part of that program, they also try to recruit the doctors, entice them with payments to become U.S. informants and to go to the media and denounce Cuba. If you ever see stories about Cuba's involved in human trafficking with these doctors, it's because USAID has paid off the sources of those stories who will go to people like Nick Casey at the New York Times, who did a piece about that. So the U.S. is actually trying to undermine Cuba's ability to save lives inside Cuba and across Latin America. And in Bolsonaro's Brazil, they kicked out the Cuban doctors because they elected a right winger, a supporter of the Brazilian military junta. And the U.S. government says, kick them out. And then they start begging for them to come back because they can't provide medical services of their own in the Amazon region when the pandemic hit. They started begging for the Cuban, where are the Cuban doctors? They're keeping people alive. So people started dying. Same thing happened in Bolivia under the coup government of Jeanine Añez, the U.S.-backed coup government that lasted for like a year before it was voted out in a landslide. They kicked out the Cuban doctors, and they had one of the worst performances on COVID in the globe. So the U.S., by terrorizing Cuba, is actually harming the poorest people across the region. And yet Cuba continues to produce doctors and provide its population with an education that's unparalleled even in the United States. What the U.S. is doing is another form of kind of biowarfare, where it's just depriving people of the basics so that they simply die in this vain fantasy that they will rise up and topple the evil dictator. And that's the fantasy that the Biden administration is engaged in right now. They actually believe that a few hundred people who went out and protested, who are from the ranks of the most desperate, marginalized people in Cuba, are actually capable of ending the Cuban revolution. And that's why they're not going to engage in a dialogue with Cuba. They're totally delusional. There's really no difference between them on this issue and the Trump administration, except Tony Blinken has lower body mass index than Mike Pompeo. The day after Marco Rubio demanded that the U.S. military, through its base, its illegal base in Guantanamo in Cuba, fly internet cables over Cuba and project internet to the Cuban population through balloons in military fashion so that the regime change operation can continue. So the U.S. actually wants an expansion of internet in countries where it seeks regime change, implicitly admitting what we've always known, that the internet is a weapon that the U.S. uses abroad. And then at home, it's seeking to restrict internet and provide unfettered access only to people who agree with and promote the opinions of our discredited, decaying imperial elite.
That was Max Blumenthal, founder of The Gray Zone and author, most recently, of Management of Savagery, speaking on The Jimmy Dore Show. Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Nana Jumphy. Cuban ambassador to the UK, Barbara Montalvo Alvarez, spoke to Afshin Vratansi, host of Going Underground on RT, about the anti-government protests in Cuba and the biased Western media coverage, the role of U.S. companies in fomenting the unrest with hashtags such as SOS Cuba, the effects of the U.S. embargo on the Cuban economy, which she calls a genocidal policy, and much more.
This campaign against Cuba began early in New York when the vote of the Cuban resolution against the blockade in General Assembly of United Nations. First, protesters were called. Then, the false account of the events was constructed to provoke reactions of solidarity with the protesters. And then vandalism was unleashed. Our president visited San Antonio de los Baños immediately after he knew of the disturbances. The actions of vandalism occurred hours before his first public declaration It was violent attacks that take place against police stations, hospitals, organization headquarters, shopping centers, and employees who protect their workplaces, as well as against internal order forces. For example, a group of vandals threw stones at the maternal and child wing of Cardenas Hospital in Matanzas province. And when they started throwing stones, the mothers panicked. And some took refuge in the bathroom with the children, some on the, the beds, others even tripped and fell. And as reported by our Minister of Foreign Affairs a few days ago, the launch of the SOS Cuba label on neighbors was carried out by a U.S. company registered in Florida, Proactivo Miami Incorporations, which received the certificate of validity or existence from the Florida Department of State. The certification occurred on June 15, and that same day, Proactivo Miami Incorporations launched the hashtag SOS Cuba. It was not a label created in Cuba, and it's not a movement generated in our country.
Is on that hashtag, is the National Endowment for Democracy, the aid agency for democracy, is that involved in that hashtag?
I have the information, what I explained to you about this company and the launch of the hashtag SOS Cuba. But there is another components. For example, AND Cuba, which operates from Florida, launched on Twitter the humanitarian intervention campaign in Cuba. Immediately, ADN Cuba was created by the United States and financed by the USAID for the communication war against our country. What happened in Cuba was a popular outbreak or a political communicational operation conducted and financed by the US government. And this is an ongoing operation, very active, very dangerous too. And no one could deny that the US government has an enormous capacity of online actions of unconventional warfare.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy deny all that. They say they help democracy. And we've got coronavirus, so obviously British tourists are not traveling anywhere at the moment. What do you think British tourists are going to think when they see the pictures of the protests and the continued U.S. embargo?
First of all, of course, that the present situation and the problems with the travel industry affect us, because tourism is one of our main source of income into Cuba. And right now, we are in a second wave of a pandemic. Is affect us seriously, of course.
Maybe it's 20 times worse here in London or in Britain, the per capita death rate. Tell me about the Abdallah vaccine that has been produced in Cuba despite the embargo.
You know, Cuba's biotech sector is unique, and it's widely known that Cuba has the capacity to produce between 60 to 70% of the medicines it consumes domestically. At the early stage of the pandemic, we developed new diagnostic kits, for example, for SARS-CoV-2, create the first prototype of a Cuban lung ventilator for assisted breathing, with the cooperation of British scientists. Most recently, Cuba has announced that it's three dose Abdallah vaccine is 92% effective, and it's two shot Soberana 2 vaccine delivered with a booster of called Soberana Plus have proven 91 2% effective in clinical trials. This moment, right now, more than 8 million of vaccines have been administered in Cuba.
I know there were doctors, thousands of doctors, sent to European Union countries as well. Why is it then that Washington calls you a state sponsor of terrorism? Joe Biden has not changed the designation since Donald Trump put that there about your country.
I suppose that it's not easy to take the correct decision, because in our opinion, and most of the people, many people, not most, but I think many people around the world consider the inclusion of Cuba in that list unjust. It's not fair.
What about the future then? Because, former President Lula may be returning to power in Brazil next year. Is a pink tide going to help Cuba? We've seen in Bolivia. We've seen changes in many Latin American countries. Do you think we're seeing...
I think that what Cuba needs is lift the embargo. What other nation around the world during 60 years has suffered what our people suffer because of the blockade? Some people do not want to talk to about the blockade, put it aside, or say this is a pretext to cover up the incapacity and inefficiencies of the system. Cuba never depend. Cuba depend on our own efforts. But the blockade is the main obstacle. Why is it implemented? We will never stop to deny this genocide policy because it's the main cause of our problems. During the pandemic, the blockade prevented mechanical ventilators to reach the country. Is that a lie? And that is only a one example. Well, what I want to underline that Cuba, which of course have a sense of are part of our region, to act in a common ways despite our differences. We are happy if Lula returned to the government, because Lula was an impressive leader for Brazilian people. The future of Cuba depends of Cuban people. At this moment, the authorities are widely evaluating what happened on July 12th. And in my personal experience, we have been the capacity to change whatever was need to change. But we defend a project, a system that we think is more just.
That was Cuban Ambassador to the UK, Barbara Montalvo Alvarez, interviewed by Going Underground host Afshin Ritansi. The U.S. blockade has crippled the Cuban economy by preventing critical medical supplies, food, and other humanitarian aid from getting to the Cuban people, while the coronavirus pandemic is still raging around the world. James Early served on the founding steering committee of the International Network for Cultural Diversity and was the humanities coordinator of the Trans-Africa Afro-Americans and Cuba Cultural Conversation Project in 2000. He spoke to Pacifica host and producer Joni Eisenberg of WPFW Pacifica Radio about the history of the United States and Cuban foreign policy. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera,
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Guantanamera, historic song written by Jose Marti, poet. That's one great way to introduce our very special guest, James Early, cultural educator, friend of Cuba for many decades. The accomplishments, James Early, of Cuba, you can just summarize two or three of Cuba's top accomplishments that many people, of course, don't know about.
Well, I think Cuba's greatest accomplishment occurred just beyond the midpoint of the 20th century. which was a signal and an uplift, not only to underdeveloped and exploited countries in the Americas who had come out of colonialism and then emerged to be captured into neocolonialism, particularly dominated by the politics, ideology, and economy of the United States, but was an uplift to the entire world of small communities and developing countries, that they too could seize the direction of their visions and command their sovereignty and their independence and self-determination outside of being subjected to the invasive, oppressive, and sometimes war intervention of great powers. And that has been the great benefit to developing communities and developing world, but it has also been a thorn in the side, particularly of the United States of America, which has seen this hemisphere since 1832, I think it was a Monroe Doctrine, as the American hemisphere. And Jose Marti, whom you introduced the Guantanamera song around, warned against the great behemoth from the North. He spent many years in New York City as a journalist and studied the United States very, very closely, and was very fearful of the imperial might and intentions of the United States. So I think that is the greatest accomplishment that this small country in 1959, then of 6 million people, now of just a little more than 11 million people in a world of 8 billion people, is known around the globe, not only for its resistance and its defiance, but for its seizing of its own destiny and transforming its country and simultaneously offering those benefits to the rest of the world, not only as a model that you too can do it. It has never suggested that it is a model to do it as they have done it. Fidel Castro was very keen in warning other progressive and transformative countries that the idea was not to try to emulate Cuba, but out of their own experience to take control of their destiny. And out of that, of course, has come not only one of the most educated populations in the world, free education, free medical care. According to the World Health Organization, it has the largest percentage of doctors per 1,000 inhabitants. And of course, many artists and intellectuals it has produced. And in that context, it has had its own errors and its own failures in contradiction or in distinction to the qualitative distortion of their development and threat to their economy and to their revolution by the U.S. Blockade, a term that they use, an embargo, which is enshrined in legislation in the United States of America. So that's the, I think, the major offering. And I mentioned the others about healthcare. Of course, they have produced two vaccines, and because of the U.S. blockade embargo and the economic and commercial war against Cuba, they are not able to get syringes. President Obrador of Mexico, just a day or so ago, I think, is sending hundreds of thousands of syringes to Cuba such that they can further and best utilize their own developed two vaccines, which they have also offered to other areas of the world, and healthcare and education, yes, I think, two of its greatest contributions.
Absolutely.
To the rest of the world.
Yes, absolutely. And certainly music as well. But one highlight of Cuba's healthcare system, they train neighborhood folks to go door to door to educate people about healthcare issues. And but Cuba certainly serves as a model for many reasons around healthcare. James, if you could just highlight for listeners the devastating impact of the embargo against Cuba perpetuated by the United States for decades.
Of course, it was Eisenhower who first, I think, placed sanctions. And it was the undersecretary at the State Department who indicated that the Cuban people loved and supported Fidel Castro, who had led that revolution to oust Batista, who was supported by the United States and the United States gangsters who had organized prostitution and gambling, and of course brought the U.S. variant of racism added to the historical racism of colonialism in Cuba. And so that embargo started with Eisenhower. It was really then institutionalized as an embargo under Kennedy and has been continued, what is it, nine or so, whatever it is, successive presidents right up through the Biden-Harris administration going against the presidential campaign to renew the full diplomatic relations accords developed by former President Barack Obama and former President Raul Castro of Cuba. It was Obama did not open up Cuba. He negotiated with the Cubans and they came to a compromise, which was to bring the United States out of its rogue nation position back into the context of the protocols of nations to handle their disputes and their mutual interests in ways that have been established by the United Nations since 1947. But the embargo really has constricted the Cuban economy. It was intended, as is the statement from that undersecretary during the Eisenhower administration, to really starve the people into rebellion against their revolutionary government. And that has continued with various tactical differences. That has been the common goal, is to overthrow the Cuban revolution and to have regime change. There were many, many attempts admitted by the United States government. It does not hide it, to assassinate Fidel Castro. Livestock was poisoned. Terrorists were supported in Miami. And we should say something about Miami, which has become the terrorist base in the Western Hemisphere, as we just see now with Haiti. And Colombians who were trained by the U.S. are the guy who has just been held accountable for the murder of Berta Cáceres in Honduras. The United States has, in each administration, tried to get the Cuban people to rebel against its elected government. Another point of its elected government, about a one-party duopoly in the United States. So the embargo has really distorted the economy and constrained the Cubans from doing their best with the economy. And one would surmise that they would be doing far better with their economic situation and meeting the basic needs of its citizenry, the aspirations for additional things, given what they have been able to do with healthcare and what they've been able to do with education and with cultural policy, with some of the most renowned poets, novelists, dancers, and musicians, as you have mentioned. So this embargo is our responsibility to bring the United States back into the protocol of nations, no matter what you think of socialist Cuba or of its leadership, or what ideological perspective one might support of the population in Cuba. What is our responsibility? And we should be careful to assume a kind of external moral judgment about how the Cubans are handling their own conflicts and debates versus what our role is in qualitatively contextualizing what latitude the people and the government in Cuba have to address their needs and aspiration. And that is all tied up with this embargo. Congressman Meeks, who's head of the Foreign Relations Commission in the Democratic Party on the congressional side, has called for Biden to drop the sanctions. Biden has trotted out the Cuban-American Democratic senator from New Jersey to say, no, keep the embargo. Biden has said, really cynically, we will offer you vaccines. The Cubans already have two vaccines, but we will not allow a Cuban American to send remittances back to their families in Cuba. So this is our responsibility to break this embargo, take down these sanctions.
That was James Early in conversation with Pacifica's WPFW producer, Joni Eisenberg. We thank KPFT's Akua Holt for production assistance with this segment. Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Nana Jumphy. Despite the U.S. declared permanent war on Cuba for lacking the best democracy money can buy, U.S. style, Havana hasn't stopped its social and scientific growth. It exports educators and doctors, not merchandise and soldiers. It educates thousands of medical students from several countries, produces much of its medicines, and does not demand military bases in other countries. Bita Amani is an epidemiologist and associate professor at Charles Drew University of Medicine and Science in South Los Angeles. She spoke with Pacifica's Lawrence Reyes.
So for us to be going to Cuba, all these years, we go there to study. Why is it that the mentor, the person who we go with is Catherine Hall Trujillo, who is a part of IFCO Pastors for Peace, right? So she's been part of, the training of the Elam, the U.S. Elam students for years. You know, we go with her, there because, as she says, Cuba might be the safest place on the planet for a Black baby to be born, right? While it spends less than $1,000 per capita, right, per person on health, while the United States spends around, upwards of $10,000 per capita, right, per person on health, it has lower infant mortality rates. Here in Los Angeles County, Black babies are dying, at rates that are three times higher than white babies. But in Cuba, the infant mortality rate is so low that it met the UN sustainable, development goals around that, years before. And not in addition to issues of maternal child health, having, less than 1% of Cubans die from infectious diseases pre-COVID, right? Like having, been one of the first countries, if not the first, to make sure that there was no vertical transmission of HIV/AIDS, from mother to children, as well as for syphilis, right? These are major things that are accomplished on a global scale, that so much money and investment is, is being made, but people still can't figure it out. So we literally started to go to Cuba because I got tired of being the depressing professor that's always talking about white supremacy, imperialism, colonialism, what's happening, what we don't have. And the students are like, always, themselves saying we need something universal, we need something integrated, we need something free, we need something that focuses on prevention, we need something integrated within our community health systems, we need that the community clinics to see 70%, right, of our, of what's needed versus the hospitals, the emergency rooms being the first points of care. And I was like, well, if you want to see it, you got to go to Cuba. That's been part of our history and why we go. In addition to, when we're talking about the embargo here, and obviously what breaking and dismantling the embargo means for the Cuban people, the direct ways that people of South Central would benefit from that, several years ago, there were reports put out about how across certain communities in California, the amputation rates from diabetes were 10 times higher in the poor areas than the wealthier areas, right? The Black and brown areas versus the white areas. Cuba has a drug that's approved, used everywhere globally to reduce amputations by 70%. Like, imagine what we could do with something like that.
Bob Schwartz is the director of Global Health Partners. He discusses an important initiative to provide Cuba with syringes for its massive COVID vaccination campaign.
The struggle that we're in right now is probably the single most important initiative that we've ever undertaken for Cuba, and that is to provide syringes. Unlike most countries that are scrambling for vaccine, Cuba has five domestically produced vaccines, and hopefully Mark or Peter will discuss that. Two of them are already being used under emergency use authorizations. What they don't have are syringes. And so a little less than three months ago, Global Health Partners, in conjunction with the Saving Lives Campaign, which is a coalition of dozens of local and national organizations that are opposed to the Cuba sanctions, set out to donate syringes to Cuba. And our goals, to be honest with you, our goals were very modest. We expected to raise $100,000 and to ship 2 million syringes to Cuba. Fast forward, the response has been overwhelming. We're all thrilled with the response that we've received from all across the country, and it's a very broad-based movement. We've now raised over $550,000. We've already purchased 6 million syringes, and approximately 1.6 million syringes arrived in Cuba on Saturday. What's the importance of that? You know, there's two facets of this. One is it's going to save lives. And if you look at the COVID rates in Cuba right now, they've been increasing for the last month. A month ago, there were 1,100 to 1,300 cases a day. Fast forward to the last 2 weeks, you've got over 6,000 cases a day. You've got 50 or 60 deaths every day. And that's with world-class physicians, world-class public health system. They don't have the materials that they need. There are shortages of food, there are shortages of essential medicines. And obviously, until you are able to vaccinate the population, it's not going to be a safe destination for people to travel. If they can't travel, the Cuban government will not be able to buy food. The Cuban government will still not be able to buy the meds it needs, antibiotics, analgesics, asthma inhalers, insulin for diabetics are all in very short supply. Unlike most countries, Cuba can't open up a line of credit. They can't use their American Express card. Everything is hard currency, and Cuba doesn't have it. They've been closed down for the past year. So until their population's vaccinated, they're not going to reopen. And unfortunately, the COVID cases will increase and the shortages will persist. So our goal now is to get 6 million syringes to Cuba.
And where is that goal at right now? I had a brief conversation with you earlier, and you are getting a lot of assistance and a lot of support from other nations. You want to highlight those nations that are providing syringes as well?
When Cuba first came to us, they needed 20 million syringes. The short math of it is they want to vaccinate their entire population. They've got a very ambitious plan to vaccinate their entire population by the end of the year. The vaccines that have been approved for use in Cuba are three-shot vaccines. So if you want to vaccinate 10 million people, you need 30 million syringes. They were 20 million syringes short. This was in May. So as of right now, I know the European community, the European Union has sent roughly 10 million syringes. Canada has sent 2 million. And we took it upon ourselves to raise the funds and to send 6 million syringes on behalf of the American people to Cuba. So our sense is Cuba will have sufficient syringes to vaccinate its population. And the response around the world, you know, Cuba has had an international assistance program. Despite all the shortages and all the suffering that's been going on in Cuba, Cuba still sent thousands of healthcare workers to, I think, 39 countries during the first year of the pandemic. They sent doctors and healthcare workers to Italy, to Spain, to Mexico. And this is a country that right now, if you walk into a Cuban hospital with a fever, you can't get ibuprofen. There is none. So that's the context for all this. So I think the world's response to Cuba's struggle right now is because of the work they have done internationally for decades.
We thank Lawrence Reyes, host of the show From Decolonization to Liberation on RadioJustice.org, for sharing his conversations with Bob Schwartz and Bita Amani. The world is watching, and action is not limited to nations voting at the UN General Assembly. People from several cities have taken to the streets to voice their opposition to the U.S. blockade against Cuba. Here's Ron Goches, teacher and activist with Union del Barrio in Los Angeles.
We know what the Cuban Revolution has meant for Africa and the liberation struggle there. We know what Cuba has meant for all of Nuestra America and the revolution that's happened in many countries across our continent. We know the solidarity that Cuban doctors have sent all over the world to heal people for free. We know what Cuba is about, and we are not going to let the mainstream media lie about it and say that there's a revolution happening in Cuba. I got news for them. It already happened. It happened in 1959. and they won the revolution, and they're defending the revolution. And there's a reason why the U.S. imperialists, they'll invade Iraq, they'll invade Syria. They're not touching Cuba, because they got the ass whooped before, and they know what that tastes like, and they don't want no more of that. Because the Cuban people are ready and willing to fight to the death if necessary to defend the revolution. And I remember one of my trips that I was there, I met a guy, and we were just talking. It was late at night, and we were like by the beach. And I said, what would happen if one day the U.S. invades your country? And he goes, ha! He laughed at me. He goes, ha! He said, you see every single person here? We're all were part of the Cuban military. We know how to fight, and we're willing to die for our country. And this wasn't like an activist. This wasn't like a member of the Communist Party. This is a normal person in the street who is willing and ready to fight and die for his country and for the revolution. So for us, that for me is inspiration, that we have to continue organizing. We have to continue the movement here, not just to defend Cuba, but to defend our people here, because we're under attack. Black, brown, and all poor people are under attack. And so for us, Cuba has been for a long time an example, a shining example of what a country that's poor in terms of economics can do, even if they're right next to the most powerful empire in the history of humanity. And for more than 60 years, the Cuban government has said, fuck you to imperialism, and they did what they want and how they want it, and they're going to continue to do so. And that's what we support.
In the wake of the disturbances of July 11th and 12th, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel tweeted, "The counter-revolution dreams of a war between Cubans. We are not going to indulge them. We will come out of this with hashtag unity, discipline, and work. Hashtag Somos Cuba." A caravan of Cuban Americans marched 1,300 miles from Miami to Washington, D.C. to gain support against the U.S. blockade of Cuba. Led by a teacher and veteran, Carlos Lazo, the caravan arrived in the nation's capital on July 25th. Let's hear some of their voices.
Empezamos con el coro. Guantanamera. Guajira, Guantanamera. Guantanamera. Guajira, Guantanamera. Con todos. Guantanamera. Guantanamera. Guajira, Guantanamera. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, con los pobres de la tierra, quiero yo mi suerte echar, con los pobres de la tierra, quiero yo mi suerte echar, el arroyo de la sierra me complace más que el mar. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera.
And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all Pacifica stations and radio affiliates who contribute to our weekly productions. Today's show was produced by Fernando Velasquez and Polina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. We heard music by Led Zeppelin, Arturo Perez Prado, Wilson Pickett, and Los Van Van. You can find this and all other episodes, along with our playlist and show notes, on our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I've been your host, Nana Jumphy. Thanks for listening.